This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're bringing you a story that sounds like it's straight out of a spy novel. We're diving deep into an investigation filled with intrigue, deception, and a strange cast of characters. This might be our oldest case yet, but there's plenty of physical evidence and several named suspects. We're on the hunt for a killer in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. Who murdered Dr. William Dean?
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Summertime in Jaffrey, New Hampshire is typically hot and humid, and Tuesday, August 13, 1918 is no different. As nighttime temperatures dip down to a comfortable level, Dr. William Kendrick Dean grabs a lantern and heads out to his barn. Dr. Dean routinely milks the cow twice a day, once at noon and again at midnight. But strangely, on this night, he doesn't return. His wife wonders where he is, but fearful of the dark, she doesn't dare venture out until daybreak. By the time the sun begins to rise, Dr. Dean's wife Mary is frantic. She checks the barn, but her husband isn't there. She calls a neighbor, Martin Greenfield, who comes right over with his young son. At the same time, a couple farmhands show up, and they also join the search. Knowing that Mary Dean suffers from memory issues, the Dean's neighbor checks the house, just in case Dr. Dean is still asleep in bed. But the house is empty. The neighbor returns to the barn for a more thorough search, and he notices some blood on the ground. Alarmed by the discovery, he uses the Dean's phone to call a local official. Several men respond to the call, including the police chief. They also search the grounds, but find no trace of the doctor, until one of the officials suggests they check the cistern in the yard next to the house. A cistern is an underground receptacle once used for collecting and holding rainwater for household use. As the searchers look on, one of the men methodically probes the water using a long pole. Suddenly, he feels something strange. It's the body of Dr. William Dean. Deep Water is the title of a book that chronicles the events surrounding the murder of Dr. Dean. Here's author Ken Sheldon.
He went out to milk his cow, didn't come back, and he was found murdered, hogtied.
Reports indicate that the body was immediately pulled out of the water with a large pair of ice tongs and carried up to the main house where it was retrieved by the undertaker. That same afternoon, the first autopsy was conducted by a Dr. Dinsmore in the presence of the county solicitor, the sheriff, and others. Here's Bruce Hill, an archivist from the Jaffrey Historical Society.
The first autopsy was very cursory, and that was done by a local physician or maybe the county coroner.
Here's a partial account of the original findings. The upper part of Dr. Dean's body was covered with a sack. Inside the sack was a 27.5-pound stone. They also found a light horse blanket wrapped around his head. When that was removed, a piece of rope was discovered wrapped around his neck. The report says that the rope creased the skin deeply on one side. The same report goes on to describe how Dr. Dean's hands were tied behind his back, and his legs were tied together above the knees and around the ankles, and there was a cut and other wounds along the left temple. Here's author Ken Sheldon.
Initial reports in the newspaper said he was drowned because he was found in the cistern, but that was not correct. He was dead before he went into the water. His neck was broken, but he had also been beaten. He had scars on his head. The ropes were still around his neck when they found his body, and it was clear that they had been pulled with enough force to break his neck. So that's what did him in.
Now, keep in mind, the year is 1918. It's hard to imagine what life was like back then, especially since the United States was at war with Germany. But it was actually just a few short months before World War I would be over. It's also the height of summer in New Hampshire, and as we mentioned, in August of 1918, it was exceptionally hot, and the residents of the small town of Jaffrey were, let's just say, they were on edge. Ken Sheldon.
I think it being at the end of World War I, it was a time of kind of heightened tensions. People had been told by President Wilson to keep an eye out for suspicious activity, kind of like now. You know, if you see something, say something. And especially in a small New England town where everybody knows everybody else's business, even more so back then. If you were lived on a lonely country road and a car went by at midnight, you noticed it, because that kind of thing didn't happen that often. And so although it was a very kind of rural area, people were on kind of a heightened sensitivity to anything they perceived that might be espionage or that kind of thing.
So there was a lot of suspicion at the time that spies were sending messages from Mount Monadnock in New Hampshire to German warships and submarines in Boston Harbor. Here's Bruce Hill.
Now, this is Mount Monadnock. It's a single mountain that stands alone by in town here. From the summit, on a clear day, you can see Boston. You can see the skyline of Boston. Theoretically, you can see Boston Harbor. And you can see other mountains in between. So the theory being that a German spy could watch over troop movements at a nearby Fort Devens and then signal those troop movements to from mountain to mountain, or even to Boston Harbor, to submarines or ships that were waiting out of the harbor.
And in Jaffrey, there's a lot of chatter about people seeing flashing lights coming from the mountain. Again, here's Ken Sheldon.
Well, the theory was that people began to see lights flashing from Mount Monadnock, and because they had been told to be on the alert, the rumor started, or the idea got in people's heads, that these were German spies flashing messages over to the seacoast.
I asked Bruce Hill if the sightings were believable.
It was credible enough that people believed what they saw, and there were so many reports of these lights that they were dismissing fact that it's just car lights or a hiker up on the innocent hiker. There were just too many coincidences, too many details that proved worthy of further consideration.
According to Ken Sheldon, it wasn't just one or two sightings.
A lot of people reported this, especially some of the wealthy people. Jaffrey also has a contingent of summer people that come in from Boston. They have two homes, you know, and these are people that are quite connected. And so they told their sources, the people that they knew in the government, they need to come up and check this out. So the Bureau of Investigation, at that time, it wasn't yet the Federal Bureau, it was the BOI, sent up some people to look into this, the idea of the flashing lights. Was there espionage going on?
Needless to say, in August 1918, the residents of Jaffrey, New Hampshire were already feeling anxious. And then, a prominent citizen is found murdered. So, who was this Dr. William Dean? Well, he was trained as a physician, though he never actually practiced medicine. His wife didn't want him to have the hectic life of a working doctor. He's described by author Ken Sheldon as a gentleman farmer, with a home on what's known today as Dean Farm Road. A winding dirt path leading up to his hilltop property with a large house, a smaller cottage, and, as you now know, a barn. The murder investigation begins immediately. Or should I say, investigations. Here's Ken Sheldon.
Well, the primary investigator for the case was the county solicitor for Cheshire County. And the county solicitor was, in effect, the district attorney of the time. A young guy named Roy Picard, hadn't been on the job that long, had already developed a reputation for being tough on crime. He brought in a Pinkerton agency detective. The Pinkerton agency came out around the time of the Civil War, became famous for protecting Abraham Lincoln, at least for most of the time. They were assigned to that job. They were kind of the primo detective agency at the time.
At the same time, a separate investigation was underway, led by a man who was hired by Frederick Dean, Dr. Dean's brother. This investigator was a peculiar man from New York City. During that era, he may have been referred to as a sleuth.
The victim's brother, William Dean's brother, Frederick Dean, had made an acquaintance in New York of a guy named William DeCurler. DeCurler is a fascinating character. He was kind of a showman. He pitched himself as being a psychic detective. He had a history that went back to public speaking, but he was in New York at this point, pitching himself as a journalist and a quote-unquote psychic detective. And so Mr. Dean's brother knew him and invited him to come to Jaffrey and look into the case, and he did. And he managed to infuriate some people there because he was kind of a bull in a china shop. And he asked a lot of questions that other people weren't asking, which annoyed some people. And also because, again, this is New Hampshire filled with reticent country people, not used to having their doors banged on at midnight with somebody with a bunch of questions about a murder that they were already hesitant to talk about.
Dr. Dean's brother not only brought in his own investigator, but he also demanded a second autopsy. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Author Ken Sheldon said there were several witnesses interviewed during the intensive investigation. Some of that may not have been widely known at the time, but now because of Ken's research and Freedom of Information Law requests, he's uncovered quite a few details.
There were a lot of witnesses. The challenge was that a lot of people were hesitant to talk unless they were sort of forced to. So a lot of what we know now is only thanks to stuff that happened later on. You know, a grand jury hearing whose records were sealed for 60 years and which were later unearthed and translated. Newspaper reports and articles and stuff like that, FBI reports that were not public knowledge at the time, and now we have access to what those people saw.
At the time of the murder, the FBI, as Mr. Sheldon mentioned, was actually called the Bureau of Investigation, the predecessor to what we know today as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So back to that second autopsy I mentioned earlier. Dr. Dean's body had been buried on August 17th. But about 2 weeks later, on August 30th, the body was exhumed at the direction of Dean's brother. Some photographs were taken at that time. You'll find a link in our show notes. And although Frederick Dean would step back from the investigation, the town of Jaffrey chose to continue with the services of the psychic detective William DeCurler for the remainder of the investigation. That second autopsy was performed by an experienced doctor out of Boston. And among the people present at that autopsy were a special agent from the Bureau of Investigation's Boston office. I want to share a few details of that autopsy report with you because I think it'll give you a good understanding of some of the circumstances surrounding Dr. Dean's death. Here's what the pathologist said. There was blood staining or hemorrhage on the subcutaneous tissues of the large neck muscle that starts at the bottom of the neck and ends at the base of the skull. There was a fracture of the hyoid bone, a bone in the neck often fractured in cases of strangulation. There were fractures to the spine and skull, with a specific description of a piece of skull about 3 centimeters square that was freely movable. So you've heard the long list of horrific and catastrophic injuries that Dr. Dean sustained, but according to Dr. McGrath, the findings confirm that the actual cause of death was asphyxiation. And in blunt detail, Dr. McGrath concluded, quote, "The murder was not committed in a hurry to get the body out of the way, but to make absolutely certain it was dead," end quote. And the evidence found at the scene? What did that say about the crime? One of the amazing things about this case is the volume of evidence surrounding it. Remarkably, in the 1980s, several stenographers' notebooks containing the proceedings of the grand jury from back in 1919, the year following Dr. Dean's murder, were discovered when the Keene Courthouse was moving from its original spot to a new location. But also unearthed in the recesses of the courthouse were many of the items found at the actual murder scene. These items, by the way, are now in the possession of the Jaffrey Historical Society. I asked Ken Sheldon about the original evidence that was discovered in the courthouse and those items that were not.
The things that were used in the murder of William Dean were all things that came from the farm. The rope had been something that was hanging around where he was. There was a burlap sack put over everything. Underneath that, there was a horse blanket that had been wrapped around his head, I think, to contain the blood from the bruises that he had been given. His hands and feet were tied with cords that had been taken. Everything came from the barn, which to me was kind of telling in terms of the intent of these people when they went there. But there was also a box, and in that box was the clothes that Mr. Dean was wearing the night he was murdered, the rope that was tied around his neck, a bloody doorknob to the barn where he was murdered, the ropes, chains, I think, and some pieces of wood with blood spatters on them. So there was a fair bit of that kind of evidence. But, as you asked, there's also evidence that was missing.
So let's talk about one of the missing items, a cigarette case. Something commonly carried during the time, whether you bought cigarettes or rolled them by hand. When Dr. Dean was pulled from the cistern, his cigarette case was still in his pocket. But the day after the murder, when the cistern was drained, they found a second cigarette case. Could it have fallen from the killer's pocket when disposing of Dr. Dean's body?
When they drained the cistern, and sure enough, there was a cigarette case in there. And they pulled it out, threw it on the grass to dry out. And later on, that cigarette case disappeared. It was an incredibly important piece of information. And the fact that it disappeared is really damning in terms of the people who were in charge at the time.
It appeared that something peculiar was going on. I asked Ken about the missing cigarette case. Could its disappearance be a simple accident, a mishandling of evidence, or purposely lost to protect someone's identity?
My suspicion is the latter. And there was this confusion over which case was the one found in the cistern, which one. Mr. Dean had a cigarette case on his body when he was discovered. Another cigarette case was discovered in the house where he lived. And these three cigarette cases passed hands back and forth. And it was like a shell game trying to figure out, you know, where one went. But at this point, by the time of the grand jury, they ended up with two cigarette cases. And to my mind, neither one of those, and to the mind of several witnesses, neither one of those was the one that was discovered in the bottom of the cistern. Nobody knows what happened to that cigarette case. It still hasn't turned up to this day. And in my mind, the only reason for it to go away was because it implicated somebody. There were a few other things that never showed up. Shortly before he died, Mr. Dean received a threatening letter in his mailbox. It wasn't posted. Somebody just wrote it and put it in. One witness who talked with him about it said that it had something to do with dropping him in a well. And it was a threatening note. That letter has disappeared. We don't know where it is.
And the question remains, who would want to kill Dr. Dean? Who wanted to make certain he was absolutely dead? And why? I asked Ken Sheldon about possible suspects. He says it boils down to just three people. Dr. Dean's wife, Mary. Mr. Lawrence Kohlfeldt, a former tenant of the Dean's, thought by some to be a German spy. And Mr. Charles Rich, a well-known banker, judge, and supposed close friend of Dr. Dean. Let's start with the first suspect, Dean's wife, Mary. At the time of her husband's death, she was 67.
She really, if you met her, didn't know her before, you wouldn't notice necessarily, but she would forget things. She would get her words mixed up. She was ostensibly the last person to see her husband alive. And because she was in dementia, some people thought that she was insane and that that's how she had done this.
But according to Dr. McGrath, who performed the second autopsy on Dr. Dean, and based on his findings, he said, quote, Mrs. Dean could not have committed the murder. It required more strength than she possessed. She was too frail, mentally and physically, end quote. He told investigators they should look elsewhere. The next suspect on the list is Lawrence Kohlfeldt. The Deans had been having some unfortunate health and financial troubles, and they found a way to make some extra money.
The Deans had two houses. They had a small cottage they lived in. They had a big summer house that was higher up the hill, and they had been renting that out to make some money. And one of the people they rented it to was Lawrence Kohlfeldt. And Kohlfeldt was essentially a trust fund baby. His grandfather was from Pennsylvania. He was a millionaire, very active in politics down there. And he had left his daughter and his grandson a lot of money. And so Kohlfeldt lived an easy living life. He had plenty of money. He didn't work or appear to work. He threw his money around. He had a big Marmon automobile, which is a grand size auto of the time up there with like Rolls Royce, you know. He had horses and he spent his time riding around the area in his car and in his on his horses. And again, this was a time of wartime when basically it was either work or fight. You were expected to go off to war or do something at home to support the war. And here's this guy throwing his money around, living the high life, and has a last name, Kohlfeldt, that sounds German. So if you wanted to attract attention in the town of Jaffrey at the time, this would be the way to do it. Well, you know, he had lived in Mr. Dean's house until about a month before Mr. Dean was murdered, and then he moved away because they had a falling out.
Next on the list of suspects was Charles Rich, manager of the Monadnock Bank in Jaffrey.
And Rich was a very powerful, politically connected guy. He was a judge in town. He was the Grand Master of the local Masonic Lodge. He was very close and connected with all the businessmen in town, the men who owned the mills and factories in town. He also apparently was one of Mr. Dean's closest friends. And among the first people to show up at the farm the day of the murder to look for his body. But when he did, he had scratches on his face and a kind of a black eye that he attributed to a kick from his horse.
But there seems to be a problem with the explanation for the black eye given by Mr. Rich, says Ken Sheldon. As Rich explained his injury to various people, his story changed slightly each time. And there were witnesses who said that Rich's horse was not actually in the barn at the time he said it kicked him. This was a difficult case from the beginning. Multiple investigations, two autopsies, and there didn't seem to be enough solid evidence that pointed to any one suspect. So about 8 months after Dr. Dean's murder, without any resolution, a grand jury was impaneled to hear the case. Many in the community did not believe that Mary Dean could have been involved in her husband's death, given her physical and mental capacity. So, if the Dean's former tenant, Lawrence Kohlfeldt, and Dr. Dean's supposed friend, Charles Rich, were the better suspects, why did it seem that the grand jury investigation focused so closely on Mary Dean?
The county solicitor, Roy Picard, leaned heavily toward the idea that Mrs. Dean had done it. So, you had this kind of dividing line of who people thought was responsible, mainly, you know, Mrs. Dean or Charles Rich. And that dividing line separated the town of Jaffrey for decades. There were people who, even to the point when I was a younger person in high school and college, people would not talk about it because they were afraid. At the time, they were afraid that whatever happened to Mr. Dean would happen to them if they talked. And two, if they worked in the mills and factories and they said what they really thought, they were afraid for their jobs. So that's kind of the way it broke down in terms of suspects.
I asked Jaffrey Historical Society archivist Bruce Hill about his thoughts on the suspects and the possible theories and motives for the murder of Dr. Dean.
It's more a case of ruling out suspects, and this is just my opinion, that Mary Dean could not have possibly done this alone, and probably not even with her mental capacity. So I rule her out quickly. Kohlfeldt earned a bad reputation figuring that he was a German spy, when in actuality he was Irish and had no connections or no evident connections to Germany at the time. A strange character, lived an unusual life, certainly was suspect because of those conditions. But I think Mr. Rich was complicit in some regard. Now, my grandparents, I think I point blank asked them, and they were in their 30s at the time this event happened. So they were well aware of what it was. And I can remember their words saying, using the word Kohlfeldt, sort of disdainfully, but they also said, Mr. Rich, he had some bad mannerisms as well. And certainly his black eye was a condition that couldn't be ignored. Could he have done it alone? I doubt any one person could have done this alone. With all that happened to Mr. Dean, it seemed to be more likely that it was involved several people. And the fourth theory, of course, was there was a gang of hoodlums that were, and it might have been accidental. Of course, in the very beginning, it was thought that Mr. Dean committed suicide. But as one of the townspeople so eloquently put, he'd have to be pretty smart, that Mr. Dean, to knock himself over the head, strangle himself, tie himself up and wrap himself in the blanket and put himself down the cistern and close the cover afterwards.
Did someone have a motive to silence Dr. Dean because of the information he knew? The day before he was killed, Dr. Dean told Jaffrey resident Aria Morrison, who was traveling to Boston the next day, that he had important information to reveal to the government. He didn't provide specifics, and he wasn't going to use a telephone to relay sensitive information. What did he want to reveal? Did it have something to do with his tenant, Mr. Kohlfeldt? Or perhaps the mysterious lights appearing around Mount Monadnock. Bruce Hill told us about that conversation.
Tell them that I have some very important information and to come and see me immediately. And she said, well, why don't you just tell me what it is and I will relay that. He said, it's much too dangerous for a woman to know. And so he wouldn't tell her what it was, but that was the night before he was murdered.
This intriguing clue led nowhere. Ken Sheldon and I spoke about the physical evidence in the Dean case, the ropes, the bloody doorknob, the burlap bag, and the horse blanket. DNA science was unheard of at the time and was almost 70 years away. But in recent years, advances in DNA technology have opened the door to examine evidence that was previously unidentifiable. But for this case, there may be some obstacles.
The sad thing is, they have this evidence, but it's useless at this point. The bloody doorknob, they used to take it around to schools to show kids, and they would pass it from person to person. There's no way to get a clean sample at this point from those things.
If there was even a remote possibility of getting DNA from any of the original evidence, how would the DNA profile be compared to first eliminate Dr. Dean himself, and then the suspects? There will never be a prosecution in this case, so we can't expect any exhumations. But today we have genetic genealogy, which can examine DNA profiles of family members, descendants, for example, to help determine whether a suspect profile is included or excluded.
Therein lies a challenge. The Deans, Mr. and Mrs. Dean, were cousins. They actually grew up together. He was raised by his uncle. So they had decided because they were cousins, they chose not to have children. And also, Charles Rich and his wife Lana did not have children. Lawrence Kohlfeldt, he had a stepdaughter, but she was not directly descended from him. And as far as I've been able to determine, he had no other descendants. So we're kind of stuck.
Dr. William Dean was initially buried in Jaffrey, but only for a short time. His body would be moved to Rochester for final burial. The investigation into this murder is deep and complex. Ken Sheldon spent years researching grand jury testimony, FBI documents, newspapers, and historical archives.
Imagine you've been given a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, but you haven't been given the box with the picture on top, so you don't really know what the picture is that you're putting together. You're not sure you got all the pieces, and it may be that some of the pieces that you have don't go to this puzzle. That's what it was like trying to, figure out the Dean murder.
Bruce Hill talked about the historical significance of this case.
There's so many new people in town that are not second, third generation here that have no idea that this even happened, but yet they have this historical curiosity. So once it becomes like we celebrated the anniversary of it in 2018, then it comes to light and people are interested and curious about how this happened and what are the details. It's gone from dividing the community to being a historical curiosity, I would say.
For all of the research that Ken Sheldon's done, and with his intimate knowledge of the Dean case, I had to ask him who he thinks did it.
Well, I always get asked that question. In fact, when I was writing and researching the book and I'd go around Jaffrey, I'd talk to people and they would inevitably lean in and say, who did it? And my answer is that it's still an unsolved mystery.
I spoke with Dave Fletcher, a current resident of Jaffrey.
So I live on Dean Farm Road. I live kitty corner across the street from where this farm was. So I was talking to somebody, I think at the local hardware store, and mentioned I lived on Dean Farm Road. They go, oh, did you know about the murder? Thinking initially something recent. No, I didn't. And then they went into telling me the brief story about back in the early 1900s, that the town, one of the physicians in town, and the murder. I think it's just going to be one of those things that's never going to be solved. It's always going to be a mystery.
I asked Ken Sheldon what motivated him to keep this story alive.
This needs to be done partly out of trying to get some justice for Mr. Dean, that he was a good man. He was a patriotic man. Everybody loved him. And a great injustice was done to him. And I thought, you know, the fact that it happened 100 years ago, it doesn't matter. And if I can bring some clarity and justice to this case at this point, then it's worth doing.
All of the subjects involved in the original murder investigation of Dr. William Dean have since passed. But it's a cold case that still draws a lot of gossip and speculation. And in spite of all the photographs, evidence, and testimony that still exist, there will probably never be one single convincing answer to the question, who killed Dr. William Dean? And for all of the case details you've heard in this podcast, we've only scratched the surface. There's a lot more information, including Picard's refusal to look beyond Mrs. Dean, tampered witnesses, spy caves on Mount Monadnock, and an alternate theory that a gang of hoodlums committed the murder. More information on this case, including photographs and research materials, are available online through the Jaffrey Historical Society and in Ken Sheldon's book, Deep Water. We have links to all of these in our show notes at apbcoldcase.com. A special thanks to Ken Sheldon, author of Deep Water, Bruce Hill from the Jaffrey Historical Society, and to Dave Fletcher. Be sure to share the link to this episode and follow us on social media.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.